Hi.
I want to take up this morning. This morning we'll look at the Sedra Vayigash and the very end. An interesting area, beginning in Perek Mem Zayin, Pasuk Yud Gimel. There's a long gap in the Torah. A narrative that was interrupted, the narrative relating to the famine and the crisis that was affecting Egypt, and that was really interrupted by Yosef's personal story. Now, the end of the Sedra really reverts to the previous story in Miketz. In fact, in Miketz, there's a very abrupt end. We didn't do Miketz last week. Let's turn now for a moment to Perek Mem Aleph. Right, Pasuk Nun Vav. Well, actually, even before that, Sas Perek Mem Aleph, Pasuk Mem Zayim, Mem Ches. Vatas Aretz B'sheva Shneas Alolik Matzim. The land produced its bounty in plenty. Likmatzim, Kometz Al Kometz, Yad Al Yad Hayotzrim. Meaning it was an overabundance during the years of plenty. Vayikbot es kol ochel sheva shanim asher hayu beretz Mitzrayim, and they gathered all the food for the 7 years in the land of Egypt. Vayitein ochel be'arim, and the food was gathered in the cities. Ochel sdei ha'ir asher si yosef nasam b'socha, and Yosef collected it, and the Torah says that he had children during the years of plenty. Then Nun Dalid Nun Hey, the famine starts. The Horaov Hoyo Al Kol Pnei Haaretz, the famine afflicted the entire land, means the whole world. Vayiftach Yosef Eskol Asher Bohem Vayishbor LeMitzrayim. Yosef opened the storehouses. He provided food to the Egyptians. Vayachazak Horaov Beretz Mitzrayim, and the famine was strengthened, fortified. Very serious. V'chol ha'aretz bo Mitzrayim l'shbor Yosef ki chazak karav v'chol ha'aretz. And the entire land, meaning people from across the world, came to Egypt in order to purchase food from Yosef ki chazak karav v'chol ha'aretz, because the famine was very strong, very powerful throughout the land. That's the end of Mem Aleph. Mem Beis begins v'yah Yaakov ki yeshev Mitzrayim, and then the story of Yaakov's family intervenes. Now Mem Zayin Yud Gimel, the Lechem Ein B'chol Aretz. So Rashi says, Chozer L'Inyan Arishon, V'Tchilas Shnei Arav. We return now, we revert to the original story. What happened once the famine took hold in Egypt? What exactly did Yosef do? Now the balance of Vayigash really describes that. What was Yosef's plan for the years of plenty, the years of famine? How did he redistribute the wealth of Egypt? What exactly did he do? The broader question is, why do we care what he did? Because clearly the heart of the story is the reconciliation of Yosef and his brothers. So what's the difference how, in fact, Yosef, as the viceroy of Egypt, was able to satisfy the needs of the Egyptians and the world beyond? Clearly the Torah is describing here Yosef's chokhmah. And I want to be able to understand exactly what this is, what Paro saw in Yosef originally. So all we know is that the Torah says that he interpreted Paro's dreams, and then he said to Paro exactly what you should do, that you're going to have 7 years of plenty, seven of famine, and during those years of plenty, what you should do is V'ato yeref Paro ish navon v'chachom v'shiser l'metz shang. Find some wise, astute person, put him in charge. Yasef Faro v'yafkeid pigitim al ha'aretz v'chimesh es eretz Mitzrayim v'sheva shnei asava. He gathered the food and then distributed. But what exactly happened? Let's understand that. V'lechem ein b'chol ha'aretz. Now, we really know what happened during the years of plenty. We don't know as much what happened during the years of famine. And that's the story here. I guess it's important to note that during the 2 years, the first 2 years of the famine, because the famine stopped when Yaakov came down to Mitzrayim, during the first 2 years of the famine, while Yosef was experiencing this agonizing family dilemma in his personal life, he's administering the affairs of Egypt in a way which was revolutionary and visionary. And that's what Torah says. He didn't let his personal life affect his professional practice. He had a job to do, and he did it notwithstanding what was going on in his personal life. And what he did, in fact, was oversee a massive reorganization of the economic system of Egypt. So what happened? Vayilaket Yosef asad lechemin b'chol oretz, ki choved harav varetz, the famine is very difficult, vateila eretz Mitzrayim v'eretz Canaan b'tnei harav, and the land of Mitzrayim and Canaan became weary because of the famine, meaning the land desiccated, became dried up, stopped producing anything, nothing would grow. Vayilaket Yosef eskol hakesef hanimtso b'eretz Mitzrayim v'eretz Canaan, bashever asher heim shovred. Yosef was able to gather all the money that existed in Egypt and Canaan in exchange for the food that he was providing. Vayave Yosef es hakesef beis haparo. And Yosef brought the money to the house of Pharaoh. First things first. What exactly happened during the years of plenty? Obviously, he couldn't just take it in because people had to eat then also. So there are different interpretations. The Ramban in Niketz says very interestingly that Yosef bought wheat at its lowest price because law of supply and demand, the more you have of something, less it's going to cost. So during the years of plenty, people came to sell their wheat to Yosef. He bought it very low. When the famine came, he sold it very high. And so they made tremendous profit even initially for the treasury of Pharaoh. Well, the Ramban has another suggestion that Pharaoh confiscated a certain percentage of the produce of Egypt during the 7 years of plenty and charged the people in order to store it for them, like a bank lends money, but banks have fees also in order to cover their own costs. So Pharaoh charged Yosef. Pharaoh charged the Mitzrim a storage fee in order to make money. So his storehouses were filled when the famine started, and then Yosef was able to implement his plan. What was the plan first? So natural. Sell it. You have it. You have to distribute it. Sell it. The Medrash says, interestingly, that Yosef did not have one set price. The rich paid more, and the poor paid less. This made for, I guess, some sort of harmony in society. If you charge the rich and the poor the same thing, so right away the society becomes even more divided into classes. And it makes for considerable unrest. So he instituted what we call today a progressive tax system. Those who have more pay more. As opposed to the unfortunate reality that exists in today's world, that commodities always cost more money in the poorer neighborhoods than they do in wealthier neighborhoods. For a number of reasons. The poor neighborhoods rarely, until recently, rarely had superstores like Pathmark, because it would depress local businesses. The smaller stores always charge more. Even the larger stores, because the poor neighborhoods always have crime problems, so it just costs more to operate businesses there. They wind up paying more than the pay. It's a little bizarre, but that's the reality. They pay more. Here, Yosef had the poor paying less and the rich paying more. Something else happened as well. So in that sense, the rich paying what they have and the poor paying what they have, that satisfied initially the social needs of the order of the day. It made for quiet, tranquility in a situation in which there's always the possibility for riots and revolutions. The most common cause of revolutions and riots that spring up from the populace is always something economic. Bread riots, a classic in the last century. bread rise. People want, they need food. So Yosef was able to quell that and make sure that that type of harmony still existed, at least at the beginning. So he kept the society quiet. Something else. Vayavei Yosef es hakesef beis haFaro. Yosef brought the money to Paro's house. So Ramban says here that Yosef gathered the money for Paro. Didn't take it himself. Didn't hoard it. Didn't take a percentage and set up an account in Switzerland for himself. Everything went to Paro. So who's kept happy? Paro's kept happy. Yosef is perceived as trustworthy. Paro has the ultimate trust in Yosef. So now it's a very good situation. All the people trust Yosef because the distribution is equitable, and Paro trusts him. So far, so good. Vayitom HaKesef, Me'eretz Mitzrayim. U'Me'eretz Kanan. Then the money runs out. Vayavo Chol Mitzrayim El Yosef Le'mor Hovolonu Lechem V'lomo Namus Negdecho. All of Egypt comes to Yosef and says to him, give us bread. Why should we die in front of you? Ki Ofes Kosef. We're out of money. So again, if Yosef was buying low and selling high, if he's selling high, so the cost increased for everybody. And naturally going to run out fairly quickly. So this was already in the first year of the famine, the money was gone. Now what? The money's gone. If you just give things away, it's a drain on the treasury, and ultimately if it's not rationed, you're going to run out also. And they had to plan for 7 years, not for 1 or 2 years. So money ran out fairly quickly. Of course, again, when you manipulate the prices, as Yosef did, you do control the extent of the supply. Because people, you know, things are cheap. People buy in abundance and waste. If it's not, you have to monitor exactly what you're buying to make sure you can afford it. So therefore, by keeping the prices fluctuating, he was able to ensure a steady supply, but that there should be no hoarding, no black market in the rest of the society. So now the money's gone, and a new situation has to be created. Vayomer Yosef, havu miknechem, ve'etno lechem b'miknechem, imafes kosef. Bring your cattle. Bring everything you have. Bring your metalfel. Money is gone. Money, of course, only has value relative to society. Money can't buy anything anymore. There's no money left. You need something else. Bring your cattle. Vayaviu es miknehem el Yosef. They brought their cattle to Yosef. Vayitain lehem Yosef lechem. Yosef gave them bread in exchange for basusim, uvi mikneatzon, uvi mikneabakor, vachamorim, in exchange for their horses and sheep and cattle and donkeys. Vayinaalim balechem b'chom miknehem bashanahi. And he guided them with bread. He rationed out the bread in exchange for their cattle, their metalton. So Yosef's plan unfolded now the first two stages. First to sell it. So vayavei Yosef is like kesef beis haparo. In a short time, Paro controls all the wealth, the currency of the land. He has all the money. In due order, and this is still the first year, he succeeds in nationalizing all the metalton, all the private property that people have. Now, all of people's personal economic wealth is concentrated in the hands of Paro. So Paro, who was already supreme, already dictatorial, but in an agrarian society where people own land and basically lived off the sweat of their own labor, now he owns everything, almost everything, because he has all their money and he has all their personal possessions as well. Vatitoma Shonahi, well, even that ran out. How much cattle can a person have, especially in a desert, a country like Egypt? Vayavoi lov bashana shenis. They came to him in the second year. Vayomru lo, and they said to Yosef, lo nechached me'adoni. We're not going to hide anything from our master. Ki im tama kesef u'miknei b'heimo el adoni. Because the money is gone and the cattle is gone. Now we have nothing. Lo nishar lifnei Adoni bilti im gviyosenu v'admosenu. Only thing we have left are our bodies and our land. That's it. Lomo namus leinecho. Why should we die before your eyes? Gam anachnu, gam admosenu, kinei al sonu ves admosenu balechem. We'll die, our land will die. I mean, land's already dead. Why don't you acquire us and acquire our land in exchange for bread? Very interesting, because rarely do you find that people volunteer to become serfs. Here the situation was so desperate, but perceived as equitable, because almost everybody in the society is in the same boat, that they came to Yosef and said, we want to be slaves. We want to be serfs. Kineo sonu v'sad masonu balachem. We'll work for Paro, just give us the bread that we need. V'niya anachnu v'admosenu avodim l'faro. We and our land will be indebted servants to Paro. V'tanzera v'nichye v'lo namus. Give us seed, we'll live and not die. V'hadamo lo teshom. And the land will not become desolate. So the people, in fact, offered to become servants. What does Yosef respond? Pasuk Chav. Vayiken Yosef has called Admas Mitzrayim l'faro. Yosef acquired all the land he acquired on Paro's behalf. Kimachru Mitzrayim ish sadehu. The Egyptians, each person sold their land. Kichazak alehem hara'av, because the famine was very powerful. Vatihi aretz l'faro. Now the entire land belonged to Paro as well. What did Yosef do? So they offered to become serfs. What did Yosef answer? No, basically. The counteroffer was he would acquire only the land, but he would not make them serfs, not make them slaves to Pharaoh. Why that is, we'll see. The Moshe Chochmah is a beautiful insight. He says, why did Yosef allow themselves to be sold into slavery? Because he had been sold into slavery, and he could not abide that. So he wanted to maintain for them at least some semblance of dignity that he had not had by Dafka precluding them from selling themselves into slavery. So all he did was take the land. But he did something else. This, in fact, left the people ownerless, landless, in a country where everything is dependent on land. Again, it's an agrarian society that's nourished by the Nile. People for centuries before and millennia after this literally live off the land. They have a plot. The plot is conveyed generation to generation. The wealthy increase their holdings, the poor lose some, but everybody exists on their plot of land, which gives them some sense of ownership. The question is then how to avoid, if in fact he just takes the land but doesn't take them, their own persons, their selves as slaves, so how does Yosef avoid a sense of discontent? In other words, they may not literally be slaves to Pharaoh, but effectively they are, because now they're living on land which was once theirs and now belongs to Pharaoh. So how do you avoid that discontent? The Torah continues. The people he transferred from cities, two cities, from boundary of Egypt to the other, from coast to coast. Yosef uprooted entire cities and transferred them, moved them from place to place. Wisely, Rav Hirsch notes, he kept the social structure intact. He didn't just drive people out and have them find new homes. He uprooted communities, cities, took them from one part of Egypt to another part of Egypt. In order, the social structure remains, but they become less rooted to the land. There's no concept of ancestral lands. There's no emotional attachment to any of their lands. It's not as if now anyone is living on the lands where they lived for generations before. Everybody was transferred. Everybody found a new home. So people then became partially empowered. The land that they had was given to Paro. But now they're given new land for which they have less nostalgia, less attachment. That land also belongs to Paro, but it's not as if they live dreaming of reacquiring their land at some point in the future. Their land is gone, and now they're living in another place in Egypt. So he redistributed the land in the in society, keeping the social structure intact. Everybody became an alien, except Rak Admasa Konim Lo Kono. He did not acquire the land of the priests. Yehok lakonim es paro, the priest was supported directly from paro. V'achlu eschukom, asher nasan lim paro, and they ate their daily allotment as paro provided them. Al ken lo machlu es admasam, therefore they did not have to sell. They were supported by paro. This is also brilliant. Why? Because every society in the ancient world, and even today to an extent, has a number of power bases. So paro is clearly the most powerful. What's the other power base in society? The religious elites. They answer to their own drummer. They are the ones who give Paro almost some legitimacy. So Paro supports them, and you find many societies, America happened to be the exception, but many societies, the clergy was always supported. That's why most of Europe has state churches, because the clergy, they shouldn't become an antagonistic power base to the monarch, so the monarch keeps them at bay by supporting them. So here, Yosef was able to ensure that the Kohanim did not stray from the reservation. They maintained their support to the Kohanim, and the Kohanim maintained their ownership over their own land. Lo machru es admasam. They were not forced to sell their lands. Now, something else happened as well. So you see, Yosef was able to keep that separate power base of priests, the religious elite, happy. At the same time, by keeping them happy, he was able to provide an implicit religious imprimatur to what Paro was doing, what he was doing really. Yosef effected a revolution society. He confiscated all their wealth, nationalized the resources of the country, transferred populations wholesale from one end of the country to the other, and somehow everybody wound up happy. How do they wind up happy? It's a brilliant stroke. How do they wind up happy? They wound up happy because at each stage, Yosef was able to say, to show them, this is the only way, this is the fairest way, it's the most just way, and by completely suppressing the growth of any rival power structure, to wit, the religious elites. So now if the priests are kept happy, they're not going to rile up the population and say that this is wrong, this is against the gods, against the ethic of Egypt. Not dissimilar, because people always remain the same. So now and the Israeli government is really a crisis time. It has to reach out to the religious parties who were not part of the coalition before for his own reasons, but also so his plans can have also that type of religious legitimacy to it, as if these parties accept the platform in this context, implicitly they accept it in the other context as well, which they might not necessarily agree to. But what happens is you co-opt the rabbis and you have some sort of air of legitimacy to what you're doing. That's what Yosef did here. Yosef was able to co-opt the priests by keeping them silent. Something else happened. Vayom Yosef Elohim. Hein konisi eschem ayom yasadmaschem lefaro. You see, now we've acquired today your land, you and your land, to Paro. Hey lochem, but something's wrong. Because again, Yosef did not want to make them slaves. Right? So what did he have to do? Because they would feel like slaves in any event. They're working land which is not theirs. Hey lochem zera, here's seed. Uzratem es adamo. You plant. You're living now in a new part of Egypt. We want this to be yours. We want you to feel empowered with ownership. V'hoyo batfuos unesatem chamishus l'faro. When your produce begins to grow, you'll give a fifth to Paro. V'arba yodos yelochem, you'll take four parts for yourself, four-fifths, l'zera sodeh, to feed the land, to plant more, ula ochlechem, to feed yourselves, v'lasher bevotechem, and to provide your households, v'lachol tapchem, provide your children as well. What did Yosef do? Another master stroke. What Yosef did was make them sharecroppers, tenant farmers, not slaves. He empowered them with home ownership, enterprise zone. So now they have incentive to work, and what are they paying to Paro? 20% income tax. Not too bad. We would love to have a 20% tax rate in Phoenix. Unfortunately, it's much higher, about 40-45% all told. 20% is not bad. So now your people have nothing. They had all their money taken away, all their cattle taken away, all their land taken away. And yet they're happy about it, but the seeds of growing discontent might still be there. So Yosef then, his fourth stage, is now I want you to regain ownership of the land. Just give 20% to Paro. Who benefits? Everybody benefits. Paro benefits. He has steady flow of income. The people benefit. They've regained home ownership in a way that does not give them any type of longing or yearning for their previous possessions. They're able now to support themselves, support their children, plan for the future, and they're all happy. Vayomru, they said to Yosef, Pasachafei, Hecha Yisonu, you've kept us alive. This is just the second year of the famine now. You've kept us alive. Nimtzochein be'enei Adoni v'hayinu avodim l'faro. If we find favor in the eyes of our master, we want to be slaves to Paro. Who could understand such a thing? They want to be slaves. What a system that Yosef cared for their social needs, their economic needs, in a way that they lost everything. And yet they wound up thanking Yosef for it. Very hard to understand. But you see, this was Yosef's brilliance. He was able. This is really interspersed. This actually chronologically goes in the middle of decades. Before Yaakov, as Yaakov and his family were coming down. But this is exactly what Yosef did to ensure that society remained stable. Now you see one thing from here, because there's much discussion on exactly what Yosef did. In fact, the theses that are written up about Yosef's economic plans, trying to project them onto a modern society. One thing you see, Yosef was not a socialist. That's the first thing. The Torah really doesn't abide by a socialist system, despite what you might read in certain journals. Because what socialism does is concentrate economic power in the hands of the state. And we really have no such concept. The Melech is dominant, but the Torah respects private property rights. Without that, there's no choshen mishpat. If people don't own anything, we really don't learn the true value of money or human relations, as well as the obvious point that mankind, you know, took 80, 90 years to learn, but socialism or communism stifle creativity, as well as personal initiative, and they leave the society, and the people in the society with depleted egos. And that's why the social societies are usually much, they're just not as happy as people who are blessed with a free enterprise, a free economy. There's a certain advantage to it, obviously, the cradle-to-grave coverage that a person gets for all one's needs, but yet it leaves the individual feeling depleted, feeling hopeless. Anyone who has a sense of initiative or has any type of ambition or drive is going to enjoy much more a free enterprise system than a socialist system. I remember, that's human nature. I remember when I was in Prague for the first time, it was 6-7 years ago, it was less than a decade after communism had been overthrown, and society was struggling with, and the same thing in not just in the Czech Republic, but in Hungary, all the countries we visited, struggling with the effects of a capitalist society. I remember meeting one guy who was taking us around the Czech Republic, and she said that most of her friends are lost. She enjoys it because she was a tour guide, she learned English, she goes out, meets groups, gets jobs, works, earns her own money. But her friends, her peers, she was early 20s, they just like to sit on the porch and get drunk. Liquor was still freely provided, as it is in all social societies. Vodka is very free-flowing in Russia, Arayom, and the highest alcoholism rate in the world is in Sweden, of all places. Because there's people are stifled, so that becomes their escape. So she said most of her friends would want communism back. They would want it back. Because even though you live a much lower standard of living,
and you just, it's not as enjoyable, but you're given everything. You're given education, you're given a job, as meager as it is, you're given an apartment, as simple and Spartan as it is, you're given health care, you're given a grave when you die, you're given everything. So if you have no initiative, you're just content, then you just live a miserable life and your enjoyment is in the bottle. This past summer, when I was in the same countries, there's not one person that we met who said they'd like communism back. Not one. Despite the fact that there's some economic hardships in Central Europe, not one person. Because human nature just springs back to life. And they recognize the value that exists in a person earning his own bread, working for himself, striving, competing. It took a few years to sink in. Not one person we met that preferred communism, the exact opposite of even 5-6 years ago, where disproportionately people were meeting said they preferred communism. And to us it was very jarring to hear such a thing. Now it's not like that anymore. That's what Yeltsin was able to do. Because just to concentrate all power in the hands of the state, in Pyro's hands, that would not work at all in the long run. It would just sow the seeds of rebellion in society. By the same token, you see a pure capitalistic society is also not endorsed by the Torah. That, man eat man, let the buyer beware, pure unbridled competition, that also does not work out. There is a limit that's placed on the capitalist system. First thing, what did Yosef see? Well, we all recognize in our society implicitly, what typifies capitalism, if you could define it? It's not just free enterprise, it's private home ownership. That really typifies the capitalist society. And the government monitors these things, so I'm happy to report that now, as we speak here today, the percentage of private home ownership is the highest in America that it's ever been. It's coming close to 70%. 7% of Americans live in homes that they own. They're not renters. When a person owns his or her own home, it gives you a sense of self-worth, a sense of power, a sense of control over your own destiny. You're not subject to a landlord or to strikes. It's your home. You provide what you want. That typifies the capitalist society. And yet, the Torah imposes also limitations on that society. But before, that's what Yosef did here. Yosef wanted to ensure, even if people had lost their land and lost their homes, that in due course, in a short time, they would regain it. That's what he said. Heilochem zera, here's the seeds, uzatem es adama, you'll plant, boyat batuos, it'll be yours, just give chamishis lapara, 20%, everything else, loch lechem, lasher, vivotechem, it's your homes again. Your homes, you feed your children. That gives a person a sense of pride, of responsibility. That's what Yosef implemented. What he didn't have, which the Torah later implemented as well, were the limitations on the capitalist system. So that we shouldn't get the wrong idea. We shouldn't think that the bailus ownership is really ours. And that's Shemitah. That's Shemitah. Shemitah means not really ours. It's Kili Kol Haaretz. See, we are capitalists, but with this caveat, that we recognize it's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's not ours. It really belongs to God. Li HaKesev, Li HaZov, Num Hashem Tzvakas. It really belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. With that limitation, which is significant, because if it belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we are just stewards of the bounty that He gave us, so in fact, we strongly advocate what's called today volunteerism, but what's called in the laws of the Torah, Tzedakah V'Chesed, that we are in charge of redistributing wealth also. Not in a mandatory sense, but in a, it is mandatory on the laws of the Torah. Not in a purely voluntaristic sense, as society has it, but in fact, in the mandatory sense of Gemilus Chasodim, that if we have something, someone doesn't have it, we have to give a certain percentage. If we have too much, we have to redistribute, give it to others, to make sure the entire society lives on a decent level. There's no doubt we reward free enterprise and ambition as well, and sloth has its own penalties. You know, we Jews could use a little better work ethic today,
than exists. The sloth is penalized. Nevertheless, that system that the Torah ordains for us, that people do own their own land, and they do work for their own living, and they can make as much money as they want, and God blesses them with Birkas Hashem Itashir. Yet it's not really theirs. And Shemitah reminds them it's not really theirs. Kili Kol Aretz. And whatever money they have, it's a gift from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Matnas Elokim. Liazov, Liakesav, Liazov. Belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore we are obligated to redistribute it as well. Property, in our view, is not ultimately personal ownership, nor certainly not the ownership of a human king, but belongs to the Melech Malchei Hamlochim, the King of Kings, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what Yosef accomplished. Vayosem oso Yosef l'chok arayom hazeh al admas Mitzrayim l'faro l'chomesh. What Yosef did lasted several centuries, this type of sharecropping relationship. They paid 20%. Adayom Hazeh means until Moshe's time, until the Torah is written. But they paid even through all the years in Egypt, all our years of slavery. The landowners, the Egyptians, were paying 20% to Paro and keeping 80% for themselves. Rak ad masa kohanim levadam lo hasel atharo. Except for the land of the Kohanim, that remained theirs as well. So, all this is very interesting. I hope it's interesting to you. It was to me. The question that remains, why does the Torah record this? I mean, what's the point, really? Granted, you learn a little economics, and we see Yosef's Chochma, but why was this recorded in the Torah? And the answer is, it's not here stam. All this leads up to the last pasuk, Vayeshev Yisrael Beretz Mitzrayim Beretz Goshen, that we lived in Mitzrayim too. Everything Yosef did, and this again, just another nuance, his tremendous brilliance. Everything he did with one goal in mind. How is he going to benefit his brothers, Bnei Yisrael, his father? How is he going to ensure the survival of the Jewish people in Egypt? And Yosef's entire economic system was designed to benefit and to preserve, to safeguard the existence of the Jewish people in exile. Firstly, and most important, when the famine came, and remember Yosef and Yosef's brothers and father came down in the second year when this redistribution was taking place. Firstly and most importantly, Yosef ensured there'd be no upheaval in Egypt as a result of the famine. Who always suffers as a result of any crisis in society? The Jews. The foreigners. Jews. Wait, paranoid. It's the foreigners. All right, you're right, the Jews. The foreigners. People who just came to the country. They're the first to lose their jobs, lose their rights. Even now there's an uproar in America over the illegal aliens. Illegal, part of it is for terrorism. Part of it is also loss of jobs and the redistribution of society's wealth. You know, in many states in the country, illegals have the right to a free education, to free health care. Either illegal, makes no difference. It hasn't turned, except in, you know, the rarest cases, violent. Because the society here is stable, and the economy is more or less stable. But if it wasn't? If it wasn't, the first people to suffer would be the illegals. The foreigners, people who are not naturally here, and then anyone perceived as outsiders, say us, or whoever it is, anyone perceived as outsiders, the mainstream of society, are going to be the first targets. So therefore, when Yosef ensured that there's no revolution, no rebellion, no turmoil, no upheaval in society, who benefits first? His brothers, the Bnei Yaakov, benefit first. Second, economic power was concentrated where? In the palace, the Paro. Vayoveh Yosef et hakesef beis Paro. Yosef brought all the money to Paro's house. And then Vayiken Yosef has called Mas Mitzrayim l'Faro. He got all the land now. Paro nationalized all the land of Egypt. So he had all the metaltalin, the portable wealth, and now all the real estate. When we say Paro, who are we talking about? Yosef. If power is concentrated in Paro's house, in Paro's government,
And Yosef is the one who administers that government. So effectively, who is power concentrated in? Yosef. That can only accrue to the benefit of the Bnei Yaakov. If Yosef is now all-powerful, because Paro is all-powerful, then Yosef has a greater ability to protect his family. Thirdly, what else does he do? V'asa'om heviro sole arim. He transferred populations from one side of the country to the other side of the country. So Rashi says here, in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Yosef me'ir le'ir le'zikaron she'en le'mot chelek baretz. Yosef transferred them to have no memory that they owned a certain parcel of land in this part of Egypt. One city was transferred for another. And the Rashi says, Vohutrach HaKosov L'chtov Zos, Torah didn't have to write this. Ela lo diachos shvachosho Yosef, to relate the praise of Yosef. Shenifskavein lo hasir cherpo me'al echov, shelo yu korin osom golim. He was able to remove the stigma of being an alien, being foreigners from his brothers. Why? Because the whole society was now made up of aliens. Nobody was native to their land. Everybody lived in a different place. Everyone lives in a different place. Everyone is new. Everyone's a greenhorn. So therefore, Yosef's brothers and their families could not be singled out as newcomers, people not indigenous to the land, because nobody was indigenous to the land. And finally, the Rishonim say, Chazal say, Rak ad nasa kanim levadam lo hisal faro. Yosef left the kanim sacrosanct, untouched, almost a separate block within the society, not subject to the normal needs of work or support, etc. Who did that benefit? Bnei Levi. Because Yosef instituted in society the notion that clergy don't work and are supported by the rest of society. Something we should be encouraging more, by the way. And that benefited the Bnei Levi. Because, in fact, the Bnei Levi did not work in Egypt. They were held to be the teachers of Israel. Yaru mishpatecha le'Yaakov v'sarashchol Yisrael. The teachers of Israel. So therefore, even the Egyptians, no matter how tyrannical they were, they exempted the tribe of Levi. Levi, the priests of Israel, they don't work, they're supported, just like the Kohanei Mitzrayim don't work and are supported as well. So Yosef ensured that there'd be one tribe that would not be subject to the economic vicissitudes that might befall his family and his heirs in Egypt. And because of that, who was able to grow in that environment? Of no avdus. Amram, Yocheved, Moshe, Aaron, Miriam, they grew up being able to see beyond avdus to a different world. And so Yosef, with tremendous foresight, really just Ros HaNolad, seeing the way the history of his people might play out in Egypt, he was able to plan for all these eventualities. Ultimately, the Torah writes all this to teach us the great chokhmah of Yosef, not just in reforming Egypt's economic system, but the way he did that, and at the same time, his primary motivation was to preserve Kal Yisrael. So what happens? Vayeshev Yisrael Beretz Mitzrayim, Beretz Goshen. See, Yosef did a wise thing, and he set his brothers up in a particular place where they would not stand out, and what did they go and do? They became wealthy and they bought land in Goshen. They bought the entire territory of Goshen. So they would start standing out again. Worse than that, Vayachazuva. They became gripped by the land. So literally means acquire the land, but Vayachazu, as the first says, is a reflexive term. Vayachazu, Lahayochez, means to be gripped by. It's not as if they own the land. The land owns them. Vayifru, Vayirbumod. They multiplied. They became very fruitful. What happened? They became lured by the exile to the extent that they stopped seeing themselves as being in exile. By Ochazuva. So rather than perceive the Golos Mitzrayim as a temporary respite,
They began to look at their life in the exile as permanent, expanding their territorial holdings by Ochazuba, psychologically becoming in their own minds Egyptians, so much so that in next week's Seder, the Ephraim Menashe, when Yosef brings his children, his sons, to Yaakov, and Yaakov says, Mi'ela, who are these? Because they looked Egyptian. They didn't look like Yaakov Avinu's Einiklach anymore. They looked Egyptian. They were gripped by the land. That, of course, changes the... There's another dynamic that Yosef could not prevent. The permanence of the exile of Egypt. The ultimate degradation that would await them. No doubt, when this happened, so Yosef, as much as he tried, recognized in Vayichi the way that his family and his heirs were going. Their end in Egypt would not be a positive one. Of course, Yosef then tells them prophetically that they will eventually be redeemed and they should be removed from Egypt, because as admired as he was in Egypt, he did not see his destiny as part of Egyptian society. He did not see his destiny as the great economist. He didn't see his destiny as the great economist of Egypt, but rather his destiny was as the leader of Klal Yisrael, the Mechalkel, the Mashpir, the one who nourished and sustained them through the most difficult times. The decline would come quite rapidly after Yosef's death. But until then, and really the most we can ever do in our lives, you can't plan for centuries ahead. You can't plan every detail, for sure. You can only try to implement the streams, courses of conduct, which account for as many eventualities as possible if people respond naturally. They respond in a wholly inspired manner to the challenges of life. That's the most that we could do. Apply our chokhma, the Kadosh Baruch Hu gave it, to implement his system, and then rely on Hashgacha and our own good choices to fully preserve the existence of Klal Yisrael. Okay. Thank you very much. Tonight, despite the rumors, we do continue our series on Tefillah with Kriyat Shema.